this stuff. I mean, it is fascinating, and
yes,
it's way more complex and way more subtle than you would think to begin with, and yet it's organized simply enough and straightforwardly enough where it's not really all that difficult to grasp once you see it laid out in front of you. It's almost as though the obvious, which is right in front of your nose, is just drawn out for you. Somebody takes you by the hand and actually shows you how each part is done. But the doing of that, the making of that order and relative simplicity, the creation of a picture of the world as orderly, as precise, as detailed, and as textured as this, has actually taken, I would say conservatively, 3,000 years. And millions of lives, and just unbelievable quantities of sheer thought and experience. What I'm doing here is so simple, it's so tiny in the context of what is available. And yet, it's not a bad beginning, and it will. If you were interested in pursuing it further, it could be done. There's nothing to prevent you from learning these things. There are no mysteries left anymore that aren't in books. Granted, learning from books can be a little bit difficult. This material doesn't translate well in written material unless you know something about it first. My experience with reading, and especially with students who begin the subject by reading, is that the material tends to make you go to sleep. And a lot of people, when they, especially in tarot, because tarot is so closely bound with this, and people have told, you know, the tarot community that Kabbalah and tarot are so closely connected, they don't think so. They refuse to believe it. Because when they've tried it, when they've taken a look at the books, which is usually where the material can be found, it's so damn boring. But that's only because it's a book. My usual analogy is learning how to dance from a book. It's not a real good method. I mean, if you're going to learn how to dance, get out on the floor with some music and somebody to dance with, and then it's fun. As a theoretical consideration on paper, it's not much use. So hopefully we get past that a little bit by learning with a teacher and in some kind of context. So we had talked about the number 10, how the number 10 came from the number 4. We are not going to talk about the mysteries of the number 22 tonight. There won't be time, but I do need to show you how the world of the number 22 comes into being from these four overlapping circles in the form of the cube of space. So what I want you to do now is I'm going to have you draw, I'm going to have you discover where the cube is in this diagram. So be prepared to draw, and again, remember, stay neat. Okay?
We're going to draw right on that diagram?
You're going to draw right on that diagram, and all the things that we discussed so far, all of the attributions left and right, plus all the 10 numbers, which are already on the same diagram, will include now the cube of space, and you'll have it all together in one picture. So the first thing I want you to draw is I want you to draw a straight line between Tiferet and Yesod, between 6 and 9.
Straight line down.
Straight line down, a vertical line between 6 and 9.
Oh, I got it.
Good. Now I want you to draw another vertical line between 4 and 7, between Chesed and Netzach on the right-hand side.
As soon as you gave me that first line, I saw it.
Aha, okay. Now draw a line between 5 and 8, between Gevurah and Hod. Another vertical line. Okay, now you've got the basis of it.
I don't see it.
Okay, yep, you're going to in a minute. Now draw a line, a diagonal line, between Dot, which is the second great point, the center of the second circle, from Dot, which is labeled D, to the number 5, to Gevurah. So draw a diagonal line from Dot to Gevurah. That's a diagonal to the left-hand side. And draw another diagonal line from Dot to Chesed, from Dot to number 4. Now you're going to draw a diagonal line from Hod to Yesod, which is from number 8 to number 9. And another diagonal line from number 7 to number 9, from Netzach to Yesod. Beginning to see it yet?
Yeah.
Okay. We'll finish it up. Now we'll draw a diagonal line from Chesed to Tiferet, from 4 to 6. And then a diagonal line from Gevurah to Tiferet, from 5 to 6. And you have the outlines of the cube, but now I'm going to give you the whole thing. Draw a vertical dotted line, light dotted line, from Dod to Tiferet, from D to 6. Draw another light dotted straight line from Tiferet to Hod, from 6 to 8. And then, of course, the last line from Tiferet to Netzach, from 6 to 7. And there you have the entire cube, visible and invisible. There is a huge body of knowledge connected with the cube of space. It is as large a set of considerations by itself as the Tree of Life is by itself. We do not, by any means, have the time to describe, discuss, or, you know, go into the cube. What I wanted you to see was how it was derived from the four circles, and now to understand how that is connected with the number 22. The cube of space is made up of the following parts. You can see that it's a three-dimensional object described on a piece of paper. And you know that three dimensions have three axes. There is the axis of up and down, that is a vertical axis. There is the axis of left-right, and there's the axis of front-back. So you can go to the ends of the universe by following these axes. These make the three dimensions of space that we all live in. Hence, we call this the cube of space. Because any three-dimensional object has buried in it these three dimensions. Now, each dimension is two parts. So, for example, we say one dimension is up-down, which is a vertical dimension, but up is one direction, and down is another direction. So each dimension has two directions. So there's a direction of up and the direction of down. There's the direction of left and the direction of right. There's a direction of front and the direction of back. So there we have six directions as well as three dimensions. But there is one more direction. It's an odd one. At the very center, where all three axes of space meet, the point of juncture of the three dimensions, right in the middle of the cube, is the seventh direction. In Wicca, and there are other forms of magic where ceremony is used to invoke the powers of the universe, there is a kind of a chant almost that goes north and south, east and west, above, below, and within. Those are the seven directions of the cube of space. North and south, east and west, above, below, and within. Those are the seven directions of the cube of space. And when we say the cube of space, what we're talking about is a description of every single physical possibility. Everything that exists in space can be described by these seven directions. It is the physical universe. So what we have was, we had the three axes that create the three dimensions, and then we have the seven directions. So we have three and we have seven. So far we have 10. Now if, and some of you have done this as an exercise before, if you were to imagine extending your imagination or your thought or your mind to the ends of each one of these seven directions, If you could imagine going as far in that direction as you can, until you can think of nothing more in that direction, there drops what could be called a curtain of ignorance, or a curtain of repetition. When you can think of nothing more, and all you can do is repeat yourself in that direction, when stars and galaxies give out, and you can't imagine anything but more stars and galaxies, or whatever your imagination brings you to when you look forward or backwards or up or down, in each of those directions, there falls a curtain, a blank. So each one of those blanks, which represents your limit in that direction, is a wall, a face of a cube, seen from the inside. So you could say that the limits of your cube of space, the limits of each person's cube of space, is somewhat different. What is contained in my cube, and the way my cube is defined by my own limitations, would be different than for each of you. Although there are some places, there are some areas of my cube that overlap and coincide with yours. There are things we know and hold in common. And that's how it is that we're able to communicate. Only by those things which we hold in common. There are those things which we hold separately, which nobody else knows but us. And in that, we are completely unique. Now, the six faces in the center, which create a kind of enclosed universe. The six faces, anyway, the center, it doesn't have quite this quality. It's a little bit different. But the six faces of the outer walls of the six directions, they meet. Where up meets left, where down meets right, etc., where all those faces meet. The place where they join, the place where they meet, is described by a line. If you look at the picture of the cube, right now in front of you, you'll see that each face is connected to each other face by a line. And the lines that connect the six faces number 12. So there are 12 connecting lines which create the equal squares of this cube. This is a conceptual thing, remember, but it also is true in a very deep way. So what you have is three dimensions, seven directions, and 12 connections. And 3 and 7 and 12 make 22.
So can you repeat that? 12 connections, seven directions?
Mm-hmm. And three dimensions.
And three dimensions, okay.
Now these 22 parts that create the cube all are given one letter of the Hebrew alphabet to represent them. There are 22 letters, as it happens, in the Hebrew alphabet, and this cube is made up, isn't it amazing, of 22 parts. And it just so happens that there are 22 major arcana in a deck of tarot cards. And each one of the major arcana is given a letter. And each letter is given a portion of the cube. And so, the 22 trumps, when you understand them properly, literally describe the nature of consciousness, what you can know, and the limits of your ignorance. And that, the continuation of that, and all of its implications, we're going to get to next week when we do the last class. I had to show it to you at this point because it is from the four worlds. The diagram of the four worlds that the cube is derived. And so you see here at one time, in one diagram, at one glance, all the mysteries of 4 and 10 and 22. And you realize that when you hold a deck of cards in your hand, the tarot deck held in your hand is all the different things that it takes to make this picture possible. As a deck of cards. It's the same thing. We haven't yet discussed the court cards, which are the last part of the picture, but before we're done tonight, we'll find their proper place in this whole diagram as well. Now that should lead to some interesting questions. Does anybody have any thoughts on any of this?
Well, I was thinking, this is Gina Wall. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about the, I mentioned the rotation. I'm connecting with it, the way that it works for sacred geometry.
Uh-huh.
They do a rotation and they get the exact thing, but I think they refer to it as Metatron's cube.
Well, that may be. It's something that I don't know. Actually, the problem with this study is that there's so much to know that it takes very little to demonstrate one's ignorance. And I know very little of sacred geometry. I don't know its principles, and I don't know very much of its facts, or its history, or its uses. So you've caught me. I don't really know this stuff. I only know this particular piece of it because it's important in the work that I do. Mm-hmm. Do you have a way in which the processes of sacred geometry are important to your studies or your work?
I kind of am doing this in a in a way where I don't know if I told you this before, but it's like I started, before I even got into tarot, I started with Kabbalah, reading on my own, and as well as sacred geometry.
Uh-huh.
Just kind of found that, I don't know, it has many, many connections. And I don't know that as of why.
Yes, I can imagine.
I know that I have to know this stuff, and for whatever reason, I haven't discovered yet. But
right. Well, then it's just simply part of your path,
right?
And your karma, so to speak, to know these things. And each of us will, as we pursue these things, pick on various pieces and parts, and each of us will become expert and very familiar with different parts of it. Shahrazad, you have familiarity with many things that are associated, connected with this stuff, do you not?
Yes, I do.
And I'm sure that your version of things is as distinct and as individual as Gina's and as mine. And
I'm sure it is, and there's different interpretations, even though the foundation may be the same.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You remember, I think, at the very beginning of this course, one of the very first concepts that I introduced to you was carried in the two Hebrew words, derech and nativ. And derech, if you remember correctly, was the public highway, laid out with signs, and it's a four-lane road, and it's got, you know, directions and rest stops and police, and you know, everybody is traveling in the same way at the same time, and the laws are the same for everybody. It's the highway of general information. It's that portion of the study which we all hold in common. It's the base that you were talking about, the common denominator of all our individual efforts. And then there's the nativ. The nativ is the private path, the way each of us pursues our own goals, the exit from the highway that each of us personally takes, and each one will take a different one. And each path that we personally take will depend on the main body of information, but will go in its own way. And each of us will only speak to each other in general and approximately, so that what Shahrazad knows and works with will be familiar to me vaguely, but I won't know the details, and vice versa. And each of us here will have experiences of this material, either large or small, either long-standing or new, which will be quite different from everybody else. And if you find this subject fascinating, even if it's new to you, the chances are that as you go along through your work with tarot and just in life in general, you may find that you pick up a lot more along the way. Once you become familiar with this, you will hear echoes of Kabbalistic thought everywhere.
Oh, yes, definitely.
You'll see the force and form of things, the left and right of things, the male and female of things, the tetragrammaton of things, the energies of the elements and things everywhere. And you'll be amazed at how the world takes on a totally different complexion and shape based on your knowledge of this stuff. Now, I'm going to spend a little bit of time, and I'm going to give you another very interesting quality about this set of four circles, from which a great deal of very important material derives. Some of you, again, will have heard this before because I've spoken of it in other contexts. Some of you will not have heard it. There will be some new things even for those of you who have heard it before. But you will notice when you look at the four circles that they overlap. We've been paying attention to each circle by itself, and each circle has its own qualities. Each world is a universe of its own with its own aspects. But there are three places where two circles overlap and create a common area, something that they hold together, something that is more and different than either one by itself. These areas have a shape, a distinctive shape. They're not exactly oval. They're sort of almond-shaped. They have two names, two fairly common names. They mean the same thing. You may have heard of one or both of them. This shape is called a vesica. It's spelled V-E-S-I-C-A. Another name for it is a mandorla, spelled M as in Mary, A, N as in Nancy, D-O-R-L-A, which I believe means almond or almond-shaped. Vesica, by the way, the dictionary definition of vesica is a bladder, which is not very appealing and not a very pretty name, but it is called that, and it's also, a vesica is simply has simply become known as a vessel. You'll notice that it is a stylized version of female genitalia. That's intentional. The circle itself is an extremely feminine shape. In the universe's symbols, the line is considered masculine and the circle feminine. They're symbols of those two conditions. This shape that we have here, which is the vesica, is specifically female sexual shape. Femininity by itself isn't necessarily sexual in its content or its implications, but this is. What you have is the descending of feminine energy, level after level, where intensity builds on intensity. And as the intensity is created and built, and is demonstrated or shown in the form of these overlapping circles, what you have in the overlapped areas is a picture of feminine orgasm.
Wow.
Yeah. So what you're looking at here is the creation of the universe as we know it, with all of its shapes, all of its forms, including the father and the son, including the masculine of things as well as the feminine. Everything that is created from the top to the bottom is essentially feminine sexual energy. There is in this tradition a word that some of you may be familiar with, and that is the Shekhinah. It's spelled S-H-E-K-H-I-N-A. At least that's one version of the spelling. And the Shekhinah is the feminine spirit, the feminine version, the feminine energy of the divine. And it is said that the world is created as the Shekhinah descends. So from that point of view, the entire structure that we see here and everything that we experience here is one or another version of the descent of the Shekhinah, the descent of the divine feminine. From that perspective, the intuition that this whole world is basically feminine, of the feminine thing, is very, very correct. The Shekhinah is probably the ultimate form of the goddess as it's understood in this tradition. The use of the word goddess can be understood, can be a problem for some people with this tradition. Just take it under advisement. Those people who know it and revere it and can use it, let them do so. People who find the term goddess to refer to the Shekhinah as a difficulty, they can understand it if they wish to.
Well,
yeah.
I have a question.
Uh-huh.
With the vesica, you know, in Christianity and then in some sacred geometry, they refer to it as the vesica Pisces.
Uh-huh. Well, do you notice that it's yeah, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Oh, and it's attributed to Christ, you know,
uh-huh.
Fish, and it's also something that's seen in a lot of churches and all that is the place where creation comes through. Why then, if it's feminine, and I understand the femininity of it, though, you know, is that creation comes through, but why is that symbol associated with the Christ then? Is there...
There is, you know, if I got into that, I think I might not survive it. It's a whole other topic. It is something that I am not qualified to speak of. It is something that could occupy the attentions of bishops and cardinals and popes, and has done many times.
Yeah,
and
it's just interesting that such a patriarchal thing would be moved into the
well, animals. The place of the feminine in a patriarchal organization has always been an area of some awkwardness and problem for such groups. They've always had a trouble finding a balance between the intensely patriarchal power structure and the clearly feminine aspect of the universe, which can't be ignored or denied, but for which they can find no proper place.
Right.
It's kind of an embarrassment.
To adapt to that.
Yeah, well, you know, there's where everybody has to find their own path.
Yeah.
Well, we have the sacredness of the chalice.
Absolutely. I mean, the sacredness of the chalice is not disputed. The sacredness of the feminine is not disputed. It's only its place in dogma that's disputed. And that's something that I don't want to get into.
Okay.
So, but I mean, your question is a good one, your comment is a good one, and it's totally understandable. So we are just about to go into the fourth and last segment of what we're going to do, and I'm going to describe this issue of the feminine in connection with its complement, the masculine, and where that comes from and where it leads to in our next section.